let's cultivate our motivation. So let the perspective of your mind expand to all the places in the universe and all the different realms of existence where there's countless sentient beings, each one wanting happiness, not wanting suffering, but all of them having so many different experiences. But all of those experiences are bound by ignorance, afflictions, and polluted karma. So all these sentient beings who think that they are individuals who go about working for their own happiness, helping their friends, harming their enemies, all of them holding on to so many identities, and yet they basically live in a world that's fabricated by their own afflicted mind. And not realizing that their ignorance is lying to them, telling them that things exist in a way they don't exist. So not seeing that, then all these beings kind of go along with what's ever appearing to their mind at any particular time. And in that way create more causes for misery, more causes to be bound in cyclic existence. So seeing them in this situation and recognizing that we too are stuck in the same situation. Generate compassion for all of us, wishing all of us to be free. To accomplish that, generate the bodhicitta, the aspiration for full awakening, so that we can be of greatest benefit to all living beings. And make that bodhicitta the reason, the motivation why we are all here today to learn the Dharma. So when we really put our mind in the Dharma and start to look at our life and what we experience around us through the Dharma perspective, then our whole vision of things changes quite dramatically. Because instead of just seeing one little planet with the star of the show, me, yeah, we begin to see a whole universe full of sentient beings who want to be happy and don't want to suffer, and yet, just like us, are obscured by ignorance. And so that puts our mental level in an entirely different perspective, you know. We can't sit and it stretches the limits of our self-centeredness, you know. when we think of all these different beings having so many different experiences and all of them being under the control of ignorance and afflictions, then, you know, we have to say to ourselves, well, how can I bellyache about my friend being late for the appointment? You know, something that's so insignificant. Or even how can I get upset about losing my job, because compared to what's going on in the universe, compared to, you know, the force of ignorance that's binding everybody, you know, my particular problems are really not that dramatic. And so we have to loosen our perspective, which may, helps the mind to relax, yeah, because we see we're not the only one who's suffering. We have to put our experience in a broader perspective. But then there's also another part of our mind. The self-centeredness creeps back in and it says, well, yes, there's all these sentient beings and some of them are starving and some of them are born in the hell realm and they have this and that. But what about me and my suffering? And they don't know about my suffering, which is just as intense as theirs, almost. But, you know? And so the self-centered thought kind of creeps up again, and then there we are, just basically, you know, talking about ourselves again. Yeah? And yet the more we stay stuck in that perspective of, you know, you can see the self-grasping, yeah? Just in the attachment to self that won't let us have a big picture of what's going on in the universe and keeps returning our focus to, you know, what about me? Even though that focus actually intensifies our own misery right now, you know? Because we all know the more we think about something, the bigger deal it becomes in our own mind. Yeah? So, you know, last night I asked you, you know, how many of you were parents. So I'm sure parents are very aware, yeah, that when starting from when they're babies, yeah, if you have a crying baby, yeah, you may hold it and bounce it up and down, but what's a good way to stop your baby from crying? Take it outside. Take it into a different room. All of a sudden, there's a change in, yeah? And the kid has to adjust and think about something else besides whatever it is that they're crying about. Yeah. Have you noticed that? Yes. With babies? Yeah? It works very well. Or a stranger comes up. I do this sometimes when I see a poor parent struggling with a crying kid. And I go up and say, hi! You know? And the kid's like, all of a sudden, they, you know, they have to stop crying and like, what's this thing in front of me? Yeah. Yeah, sometimes they cry more. But, yeah. But, you know, so right away we see that when the mind focuses on something, it becomes a bigger deal than it was before. When we switch our attention to something else, then what was a big deal very easily goes into the background. Okay? So I'm not saying that we ignore our problems and suppress things, but what I'm saying is let's put them in a proper perspective and really, you know, I know this is a shock, but the, you know, the universe is not going to collapse because we have a problem. You know, I know for my self-centeredness, it's a big shock, you know, because You know, because you know how we get all worked up? You know, it's like, oh, this person wants me to do this, but I can't do that. And what are they going to think of me? And then I have this deadline at work, and I'm not going to meet the deadline at work. And then I have to do this, but it's not working out the way I want it to, and I don't know what to do. And I might lose my job, and then I'm going to be out on the street. And, you know, who's going to give me food when I'm out on the street? And we have this whole drama, you know? Incredible drama. You know, I mean, we're all screenwriters, yeah? And we write this, you know, outlandish script. Sometimes it's drama, sometimes it's comedy, sometimes we make our life into a sci-fi movie. Yeah, but we're always the star of it. Yeah? And being the star is sometimes really a drag. It's really, it takes a lot of energy to, you know, just be the star of our own drama all the time. Whereas when we are able to relax that self-centeredness and open our heart to others, then we have this whole surplus of energy that before was just tied up in ruminating about me. You know rumination? Yeah, go round and around this and that and that. You know, all around everything that's happening, it takes so much energy to do that. Oh my goodness. So much energy. Yeah? Whereas when we can release that, then there's a lot of extra energy in our lives that we can really put out to making a positive contribution. So that's why, you know, in our Buddhist practice, we're always trying to set our motivation, enlarge our perspective, really bring other sentient beings in to our perspective, because then we see, you know, it's really, we're all in this together, and we have to take care of each other. Yeah. We can't go through life just, what about me? Okay. So now, today, as soon as I can access the file, we are going to start with chapter 3 of Nagarjuna's text, you know, which is about balancing wisdom and compassion. And so, like I said yesterday, where he left off at the end of the previous chapter, was, you know, talking about these limitless, boundless, immeasurable causes for the limitless, boundless, immeasurable qualities of the Buddhas. Yeah, and so just in case we're getting a little bit, we lose our self-confidence about being able to do this, in the beginning of chapter 3, he's going to talk about how to put this in perspective. So again, this is from the book Practical Ethics and Profound Emptiness, based on an oral teaching of my teacher, Kenzo Jambatekchok. He's not alive now, but he was quite a master. You know. Very big guy, huge, you know? And his eyes didn't, you know, one eye was the other way, you know. Sometimes very stern, and then sometimes he'd just crack up laughing. But, you know, an amazing teacher. Okay. So remember here that Nagarjuna is talking to a king who has a lot of resources. But, you know, he's not just talking to the king, he's talking to us. And whatever level of resources we have, then we bring that, you know? Whatever level of ability we have, we bring that to the table, okay? So we don't have to be a great king to listen to Nagarjuna's advice. After all, we're greater than the king because we have smartphones. And this poor king didn't. Okay, so he starts out in verse 201. Great king, listen to the way in which the signs of a Buddha arise from an inconceivable amount of merit according to the great scriptures of the universal vehicle. Universal vehicle is the Mahayana. That's the tradition that we follow. Okay. A single pore of a Buddha is made from 10 times the following amount of merit. The total merit from which all solitary realizers have arisen. The total merit that produces all learners and those beyond learning. So these are other practitioners that have attained arhatship, that are on their way to arhatship. So it means a whole lot of merit. And the total merit of the entire universe, which, like the universe, is measureless. Each pore of a Buddha likewise arises from that much merit. Okay? Your mind getting an idea of boundless, limitless, you know. And so the merit is collected through doing virtuous deeds motivated by bodhicitta. Okay, so generosity, ethical conduct, fortitude, you know, really doing deeds that benefit other living beings. So a single, I'm just going to read some of these initial verses so you can get the feeling of boundless causes that we need to create over boundless, eons. A single mark of a Buddha is obtained through 100 times the amount of merit needed to produce all of the Buddha's pores. Yeah? King, that amount of merit completes one auspicious mark. Likewise, from that amount of merit arises each of them up to the 80, because there's 80 marks of a Buddha's enlightened form, and 32 signs. So the marks are significant, but the signs are even more significant. So he's talking about the merit for the things that are not as significant, and those causes are already pretty huge. A single sign, now we're moving into the signs, of a great person comes from 100 times the mass of merit needed to produce all 80 marks, through 1,000 times the vast merit that causes 30 of the signs arises like the full moon, the swirl of hair between the brows. So all the merit from 32 signs. There's, you see on the Buddha's statue, there's a curl of hair, yeah? So all that merit is, of all the different signs, is equal to the amount that you need just for this one. That's a special sign, okay? For 100,000 times, the merit required for the forehead swirl is produced, the protector's crown protrusion, the top of which is imperceivable. So the Buddha has the crown protrusion. Yeah, so that's the 32nd of the signs. And that the merit for that is just incalculable. Okay? Yeah, that's why when we prostrate, we touch the crown of our head first. Yeah, it's a way of saying, may I too create that merit and attain that physical sign that is only possessed by a fully awakened one. So we touch here, and then body, speech, mind, and then we prostrate. You should realize that a single Dharma conch of the one who possesses the 10 powers arises from the amount of merit that produces the crown protrusion multiplied by 1,000,000, 10,000,000 times. Okay, they didn't know how to say 10 to the X power in those days. So you have, 1,000,000, 100,000,000,000,000. Yeah, how they count. Okay, so there it's talking about the Dharma conch. And I think that refers to the Buddha's speech. Yeah. And the Buddha's speech is the way that the most important way that the Buddha benefits us is through speaking. Yeah, not through his physical body. Yeah, not through his mind, which we can't communicate with directly, but through his speech, because the Buddha teaches us how to practice the Dharma, and it's through us learning how to practice and putting those teachings into practice that then we can liberate ourselves. Yeah? So speech is very powerful, really powerful. When I was a kid, I don't know if you have this in Danish, but we had a little slogan, you know, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. You know, that's what we used to say when other kids bullied us. Okay, you can break my bones, but I'm impervious. Words will never hurt me. Is that true?
No.
It's not. Words often hurt more than sticks and stones, don't they? Yeah. Words can be totally devastating. In the same way, if we use our speech, you know, in line with the Dharma, our words can just open magnificent doors for other sentient beings. Yeah. It depends on our mind that is motivating the speech, but our speaking out of that good motivation to benefit people. Let me tell you a little story. This one's a recent one. It happened, maybe 10 days ago. Yeah, I was in Boston giving a talk at a Dharma center. And afterwards, a woman, she's probably, I would say, middle 30s, you know, young woman, came up to talk to me, looking very healthy, very happy. And she said, I have to thank you because 16 years ago in Madison, Wisconsin, which was about 1,500 miles away from where we were then, maybe 2,000 kilometers away, you gave a talk at the University of Wisconsin. And I walked by the door when you were giving this talk and went in and then listened. And at the end, I got a book of yours. And at that time, I was a drug addict. That I was completely wasted on drugs. And I read your book and then I started going to the Deer Park Dharma Center, and I got myself in recovery, and now my life is very good. And I'm gone, oh my God, you know? And that wasn't even my speech, that was the Buddha's speech, because whatever I write in the book, it's not mine, it's all plagiarized from the Buddha, okay? But I thought, wow, you know, the speech of the Buddha in one book completely got her going in a different direction in her life. You know? So Dharma speech can be quite powerful, and our speech can be powerful. You know? We can encourage people, we can show people, you know, a whole different way to live. Or we can destroy their happiness. Depends on how we speak. So I often say that, you know, because in my country we talk a lot about weapons of mass destruction. So this. If we're not careful, this can be a weapon of mass destruction. Or it can be this beautiful, liberating, happiness producing thing, depending on what we say to other beings. Yeah, so for that reason, we have to be very careful of what we say and what is motivating our speech. Because our actions and our speech have a lot of results. And often we are totally unaware of the results of our actions. We just kind of go through life doing, well, whatever, you know. And my generation, our motto was, if it feels good, do it. Yeah, which again is garbage. Yeah. So we just kind of go through life, you know, where's pleasure, you know, where can I find happiness, get what I want, do what I want. You know, be famous, be loved, have people praise me, have a lot of money, you know, have a country house, either this. And we're just going to go through life like that, not realizing that our actions influence all the people that we come in contact with, and even the people we don't know, you know, because of the ripple effect, you know. We affect somebody else who affects someone else, and so on. So I work a lot with people who are incarcerated, and that's one of the big things that is an aha moment for many of them, is when they get it that their actions affect other people. And then they start looking at the crimes they committed, what landed them in prison, and how that influenced not only their victim, but the victim's family, their own family. Yeah. And then, you know, it really causes a lot of self-reflection and change. Yeah. So we shouldn't have to commit a crime and be incarcerated to do that kind of reflection, but to really see how our actions of body, speech, and mind affect others. Quite powerful. Thus, even though the merit is incalculable, it is merely said to have a limit. Just as one expresses all the regions of the universe by subsuming them in the 10 directions. So even though the merit for all these physical signs and for the Buddha's speech are incalculable and limitless, you know, we make it sound like it has a limit, just as the universe is limitless. But we talk about, you know, in ancient India, they talk about 10 directions. The four primary ones, four cardinal ones, up and down. Okay, so now the collection of merit is incalculable, but is taught to trainees as if it is measurable, okay? Which it really isn't. If the causes of a Buddha's form body are immeasurable, like the universe, then how could the causes of the truth body be measurable? So the form, the Buddha has what we call two bodies. It doesn't mean body like this. It means body like, in English anyway, we say body of knowledge. Yeah? So it means like a corpus, a collection. So the Buddha has two bodies, so to speak. One is the truth body, which is the Buddha's mind, yeah, the omniscient mind and the emptiness of inherent existence of that mind. And the other is the form body, which are different forms that a Buddha appears in order to communicate with sentient beings. So some of those forms we can't see with our eyes, only highly realized bodhisattvas can see them. Other of the forms are like Buddha Shakyamuni that appear on our earth that we can contact and learn from. But the Buddhas who appear on our earth, Shakyamuni Buddha was recognizable as a Buddha. But the other ones, I mean, they don't come with a name tag here. Says, hi, my name is so-and-so Buddha. Yeah, nice to meet you. You know, like the name tags you get at conferences? So the Buddhas don't identify themselves like that. They just appear amongst us to work for our benefit. Okay? So we're not always so sure who's a Buddha and who's not. We can't always tell. Because if Buddhas appeared, you know, in bodies of light and doing magical powers and things like that, then we probably wouldn't listen to their teachings. We would be so bowled over by the physical appearance that we would just go like this and worship them. And so seeing that, Buddhas don't appear in that way. So, you know, so Buddhas just appear as ordinary beings so that we will listen to what they say and not just worship them as if they, you know, were something miraculous. Yeah. Because that's the whole way the Buddha benefits us, is by teaching us. So we have to listen to teachings. Yeah. So I actually have to congratulate all of you who are here, because you all gave up a beautiful spring day in Copenhagen, which I know are numbered. They don't happen all the time. And you gave that all up to come and listen to the Dharma. So, congratulations. I think that was a very good choice, because beautiful spring days come, go, go. You go lie in the park and get a suntan, and what do you have to show for it afterwards but skin cancer? So, you know, you come to a Dharma teaching, what do you have to show for it afterwards? You know, you've gained some knowledge, and you can practice and improve the quality of your life and the quality of the lives of the people around you. Much rare. I mean, you can see how rare it is. How many people in this city of how many million in Copenhagen? Only 1 million? Why?
5 in the whole country.
5 million in the whole country?
5.5, I think.
I thought there were 10 million bicycles here. There's going to be at least that many people.
We have more than one.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, but, you know, compared to the number of people in the country, how many people come to Dharma teachings? You know, just a very small fraction. So, yeah, quite precious, quite rare. Okay. If in all cases a vast effect arises from a small cause, then one should cease to believe that a measurable effect comes from immeasurable causes of a Buddha. Okay? So, if in all cases a vast effect comes from a small cause, then we should not believe that a measurable effect comes from the immeasurable causes of a Buddha. Okay? So, when, you know, we have really big trees here. Yeah? And have you ever looked at a big tree and thought about how it came from a seed this big? And isn't, I mean, who needs miraculous powers? Isn't that kind of extraordinary that something this big can produce a big tree? So in the same way, you know, we can create small karmic causes that produce a big result. But also, if we create big causes, then surely that's going to create a big result. Okay? So, what he's trying to show here is how thinking about the unfathomable amount of merit needed to become a Buddha is just mind-boggling. You know? That's what he's trying to get across here. Okay. So in brief, King, the Buddha's form body arises from the collection of merit and their truth body is born from their collection of wisdom. Thus, these two collections cause the attainment of Buddhahood. Hence, in short, always devote yourself to merit and wisdom. So, this is the main point, okay? So, the Buddha's form body, the form that the Buddha appears in to communicate with all of us, the chief cause of that is what's called the collection of merit. So those are all the virtuous actions done under the power of compassion, the power of bodhicitta, the various kinds of generosity. Yeah, so it's not, generosity isn't just giving material things, it's also giving protection. It's giving, you know, protecting people in danger. It's giving love and encouragement and support to people who are mentally suffering. And another kind of generosity is sharing the Dharma. So giving Dharma books, contributing to the center, volunteering here at the center to help spread the Dharma to people. You know, so those kinds of generosity. Then actions of ethical conduct are also the collection of merit. So actions of restraining ourselves from doing negative actions. And then all the actions of actively benefiting others. Okay? So a lot there to do. And then also by practicing fortitude, which is the ability to keep a balanced, steady mind, even in the confront of suffering. Okay? So suffering when we're criticized, suffering from illness, and even the suffering that we, and discomfort we sometimes encounter by practicing the Dharma. Like your knees hurting when you sit to meditate. Yeah? Or falling asleep in the middle of a Dharma talk. You know that one? Yeah. No? Oh. Try sitting in the front row. It always happens when you sit. Yeah. So, yeah, where everybody can see you, that's where it's always. I know from experience. So all these are called the method aspect of the path, and they produce the collection of merit when done motivated by bodhicitta. And then the other part that produces the truth body, the Buddha's omniscient mind, and the true cessations and emptiness of that mind, those are produced by the collection of wisdom, which involves not only the wisdom that we talked about last, the two kinds of wisdom, one understanding karma and its effects, and the other understanding the actual nature of existence. Okay, so his whole point here is, you know, if you want to become a Buddha, you need the truth body and the form bodies. So to attain those results, we need the causes, the collection of merit, the collection of wisdom. Okay, so always devote yourself to merit and wisdom. So make these two collections chief things in your life. Yeah. So instead of collecting antiques, collect merit. Instead of collecting stamps, collect wisdom. Okay. Instead of collecting boxes and things that you'll never use that are cluttering your cupboards, collect merit and wisdom. Okay? Yeah? Do you collect all sorts of things that you don't need and you don't use? Yeah? Our cupboards, our flats are filled with stuff. Yeah? That we don't even remember we have. But we can't clean it out and give it away. So that kind of possessiveness about things is something we need to overcome in the spirit of, you know, practicing generosity. So the next verse, Due to this virtue, may all beings complete the collections of merit and wisdom. May they attain the two Buddha bodies resulting from merit and wisdom. This is a verse from Nagarjuna's 60 stanzas, so it's not from Precious Garland, the text we're working on. It's from another one of his texts, but this verse is very, very famous. Yeah, and you run into it a lot in Tibetan Buddhism because this is a dedication verse. You know, but at the end of, you know, creating merit, like how we, you know, at the end of our Dharma teaching session, meditation session, so on, how we always dedicate the merit. So this is one dedication verse here. Yeah, so we're dedicating to complete the collections of merit and wisdom and attain the two Buddha bodies. Okay, we're getting into abandoning discouragement. Because after hearing about all these immeasurable, boundless causes, you know, to create, to attain Buddhahood, then sometimes we get a little bit discouraged. Or sometimes we hear about the practices of bodhisattvas, yeah? Like we hear about that they give their body. You know the story about the tigress, you know, and the bodhisattva, you know, the tigress was starving and her cubs were starving and Buddha's previous life as a bodhisattva saw them and out of compassion he gave his body so the mama tiger could be nourished and give milk to her cubs and so they would all survive. So we hear stories like this and we go, I can't do that. Yeah, I don't want to give my, you know, I don't want to even give one drop of blood to a mosquito, let alone my whole body. Yeah. So we get discouraged, you know, we hear about the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas' great generosity of so many things, and then, you know, then we go home and we start to clean out one cupboard and we find all these things that we forgot we had, and even though we forgot we had them and haven't used them in 5 years, we still can't give them away. And then we think, but they give away their bodies. It's like, you know, I don't know. I'm kind of stingy here. How am I ever going to be able to do that? And then we get discouraged. We say, oh, it's too hard. Yeah. Kind of becoming a Buddha, that's too high of a goal. Yeah, the path is too difficult to practice. And besides, I'm just inferior. I just can't do it. Ah, you're nodding your head, huh?
Yeah, but I just think, in my way of thinking, it's also being humble or being realistic because, like, I know myself and my mind, and, you know, I'm feeling far away.
Yeah. So we feel far away, and then we say, oh, you know, like, I'm realistic. I don't want to be arrogant. I want to be humble. So that's just totally beyond me. I'm unqualified. I can't do it. And then you come to a teaching, and, you know, the Buddha's telling you in one of the texts that you have the Buddha nature, and that you can understand everything. You can realize everything. And then your mind is so stuck in that low-quality view that you say, no, 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 I don't have the Buddha nature. Everybody else does, but I got left out. Yeah? You know, somehow they were handing out Buddha nature and they ran out before they got to me. Yeah. So I just can't do it. And so we demoralize ourselves. Yeah? We're the ones who are our own worst enemies very often on the path. Not very often, all the time. You know, we're our worst enemies, especially through the mind that says, you know, the goal's too high, the path is too hard, and I just can't do it. And so we have this rigid view. I mean, you spoke it eloquently, you know, a rigid view. It's like, I know myself, and I know what I can do and what I can't do, and I just can't do that. Yeah? That's like me when my dad was trying to teach me to play tennis. Yeah? My brother learned to play tennis. That's nice. I'm glad my brother learned to play tennis. Tennis was beyond me. My dad said I'd run up to hit the ball, and it was like I was dancing, you know, instead of, you know, you're supposed to run and then whack it. And he said, you got to skip. Don't skip. Just run. And I just said, you know, tennis is beyond me. I can't do it. Forget it. And it's strange. I came to Buddha, to Buddhism, and now I think it's possible for me to become a Buddha. Yeah. But tennis is much easier than Buddha. But maybe not with this body, you know? Anyway, what I'm saying is we get a very rigid view of ourselves, you know? So, I can't play tennis, so I'm not even going to try. Yeah. When I went in middle school, yeah, in my generation, yeah, thank goodness it's changed now, but in my generation, in middle school, the girls got taught home ec, and the boys got taught shop, okay? So the girls, we learned how to cook, and sew, and make beds, and raise babies, yeah? And the boys got to learn how to make things. So, I never learned how to do anything with my hands besides cook and sew. And the whole idea of handling a saw is like, you know, because I was told, don't touch that saw, you'll cut off your fingers. Yeah? And I was told as a kid, don't try and, something was broken, don't try and fix it, you'll just break it more. So I grew up with this image of, well, I'm just inept when it comes to fixing things. So I know how to change a light bulb. Yeah, I mastered that one. Yeah, so we have the joke, how many Buddhist nuns does it take to change a light bulb? Immeasurable. Like all the merit. But, you know, so I have this image. Yeah, and that image impedes me from learning how to build something with my hands. And yet, many of the other nuns at the Abbey, you know, one of the nuns, she built all the tables in our dining room. Yeah, she's very good at that kind of thing. Two other nuns, one of them who is smaller than me, run the chainsaw. Huh? And I'm going, I'll work with the loppers. You know, the... not the chainsaw. But so what I'm pointing out is that our own self-image impedes us from making progress because we tell ourselves we can't do it. Yeah? And so that kind of discouragement, which is what Nagarjuna is going to address right now, is actually, from the Buddhist perspective, a form of laziness. Now, we think, like you said, that discouragement is a realistic self-image. Buddha says it's lazy. We're being lazy. Okay. Now, laziness, from a Buddhist perspective, there's three kinds. One is what we usually call laziness. You know, that we should all be at the park sunbathing right now on a picnic, you know, just lying around. Or actually, we should still be in bed sleeping, you know. Don't get up until noon on a Saturday. Yeah, so there's that kind of laziness. That, you know, we're not doing that. The second kind of laziness is the laziness by which we are keep ourselves very busy doing activities in samsara that from a Buddhist perspective are not getting us closer to liberation and awakening, but from a worldly perspective are called being successful. Okay? So you know how nowadays everybody has to be extremely busy and have no time? Yeah. And if you have any time, if you're not extremely busy, then people think that something's wrong with you. Yeah. You've got to be busy all the time, meeting with your friends, doing this and that, checking your Facebook, all your RSS things. I don't even know what that is because I don't check it, but they say I should. And we're supposed to be busy all the time with our vast social life. And have you ever noticed, when you finally do meet somebody and you go out to a coffee shop, everybody, they sit down and they put their phones on the table next to them. Have you noticed that? Yeah? So you sit down with a live human being, and what's the first thing you do? You put your phone out there. Then, periodically, you check your phone. And of course, when your phone rings, you pick it up. And when you see there's a text message, even it's from the public utilities board saying you haven't paid your bill, you look at it. Yeah? Because we've got to be busy. We've got to be important. We don't know how to be quiet and how to be alone and how to be friends with ourselves, and even how to talk to other live people in front of our face. Yeah. I read one article, and it was talking about how many people get into romantic relationships online. Yeah? So they fall in love online. And then it was talking about this one couple, after they fell in love online, then they met each other in person. And it was so uncomfortable talking to each other in person that they each went in different rooms with their computer and in the same building and talked to each other online again. Yeah. It's crazy. So this is the laziness of keeping ourselves busy in samsara, doing things that from the perspective of what's going to produce the causes of happiness, these activities are really dislike. Thumbs down. But from a worldly perspective are this. Then the third kind of laziness is this laziness of discouragement. Yeah. I can't do it. Can't do it. So when I was teaching third grade, I had a little boy in my class. Yeah, 9-year-old. Tyrone was his name. Somewhere along the line, some adult had told Tyrone he was stupid. And he believed that stupid adult. And so he thought he could not learn to read because he was stupid. Tyrone was not stupid. I knew he could learn to read. But because he thought he couldn't, then he couldn't. Yeah. And so how many children in our schools are held back because some adult put them down at some point and made them lose their self-confidence. And then they become adults like us, adults like me, who's terrified of doing anything mechanical because I'll break it. And, lose our self-confidence. It's a tragedy, isn't it? So when we notice our own lack of self-confidence and how we hinder ourselves, by saying, it's too hard, I can't do it, then we've got to combat that hindrance and remember that we have the Buddha potential.
Okay, so if and when you surrender to the idea that you could actually become a Buddha, then there's this, especially in the Danish society, about don't believe you're something you're not, and the risk of falling into arrogance. I mean, there's a line there.
You mean you don't want to be like Americans?
Well, yes.
Anyway. We've crossed over that line into arrogance. Okay. Yeah. So this is the confusion we have. We confuse humility and low self-esteem, and we confuse arrogance and self-confidence. Okay. Arrogance and self-confidence are two different things. Okay? Arrogance is believing that you have abilities that you don't, and announcing them to everybody else, and lording your own status above other people. Self-confidence is based on an accurate assessment of what we can do now and our potential to increase what we can do in the future. Okay? So arrogance and self-confidence are very different. Then humility and low self-esteem are also very different. Low self-esteem is, I can't do it, I'm useless. Humility is, I don't show off my abilities to other beings, and I respect other beings' talents and abilities. So somebody who has self-confidence is also humble. Somebody who has low self-esteem is usually arrogant. So when you meet arrogant people, don't be fooled by their arrogance, because the arrogance is a mask for low self-esteem. Because if we really believed in ourselves and had an accurate evaluation of our abilities, we would have no need to be arrogant and tell everybody how wonderful we are. Yeah. So, be aware of that. I'll tell you something funny here. In English, we have an expression called tooting your own horn. Do you have that in Danish? Tooting your own horn means you're bragging about yourself. You know, you have a horn. And you're boo, 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 here I am, you know? So you're tooting your own horn. You're bragging about yourself. So His Holiness Dalai Lama's younger brother is also a Rinpoche, and he's very unconventional. So I heard the story once that he was talking to somebody, you know, who was, apparently being very... look at me. And His Holiness, his younger brother, said to him, oh, have you taken up music? And the man said, why are you asking? And His Holiness' brother said, because you're tooting your own horn. I thought that was good. Yeah. So... so, you can have confidence and at the same time be humble. Okay? So, I'll tell you another story about His Holiness. This one's about His Holiness, not his brother. And I tell this story often because I saw it with my own eyes and it made a big impression on me. His Holiness was at a conference in Southern California in 1989. This was just after he... during the time when it was announced that he won the Nobel Peace Prize. And I can't remember what the conference was on now, but he was on a panel of experts. And so somebody put a question to him in the middle of this conference, and he paused, and then he said, "I don't know." And the hall was dead silent, because here was the Dalai Lama, the expert of experts, saying in front of thousands of people, "I don't know." Something that nobody else would ever do. Yeah? Would any of us ever say, "I don't know," even in front of 10 people? You know, if asked a question publicly, we would usually change the topic, make up an answer, humiliate the person who asked the question, make a joke, but we would never say, "I don't know." And there's His Holiness who said, "I don't know." And then he turned to the other people on the panel and he said, "What do you people think?" It was incredible to witness this. And His Holiness had no lack of self-confidence in doing this. There was no lack of self-confidence. He was just being truthful. Yeah. So he didn't feel embarrassed and humiliated and, you know, so on and so forth. He had self-confidence that enabled him to say, "I don't know," and still feel okay about himself. Okay? So that's how you can put self-confidence and humility together. So you people do it, and then you teach the Americans, okay? Because we don't know how to do this. Yeah. Metta, you had a question?
It was more that I wanted to comment that our Rinpoche here, Laka Rinpoche here, often, if he tells you to do something and you say, "Oh, I will try to do it," he say, "Just do it."
Yeah.
And cut through this, all this spinning around.
Yeah. Way back in, when was it? Must have been 1979. I was still a baby nun at the time. And maybe it was 78, I don't know. But my teacher's attendant said, "You know, Lama would like you to lead the meditations at the next Kopan course, you know, be the assistant teacher." And there was usually like 100, 150 people at the course. And I, you know, the attendant told me that and I froze and I, you know, so then I went to see my teacher and I said, "Lama, you know, I know you asked me to do this, but I'm not qualified and I really can't do it. I don't know enough." And he looked at me straight in the eye and he said, "You're selfish." Okay, Lama. Whatever you say. Okay. Yeah, the same thing that, you know, about Laka Rinpoche, just cut through it. It's like, yeah. Actually, that's happened to me more than one time. No, I'm just remembering now, you know, that when I wanted to start the Abbey, there was one other nun who was going to work with me, and then she got sick and she couldn't. And I thought, you know, starting a monastery, I just can't do this. This is just little old me and, you know, no big organization or anything like that. What can I do? And I went to see Rupa Rinpoche and I was talking about this to him. And he, again, I'm just remembering that he looked at me and he said, "You just do it." Yeah? That same kind of thing. Yeah, but yeah. So this is part of our job, overcome how we inhibit ourselves. Okay, so I have neatly gone over time into your break. So now you only get 21 minutes break. Yeah. So you can spend 20 minutes crying that you didn't get a full break. And then 1 minute relaxing. okay.